Hello, everyone. I'm Dale Bedell. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of United Way Simcoe Muskoka, and I am so pleased to be welcoming you to our first ever UWSM broadcast. Before we begin, I would like us all to acknowledge the privilege we share to be having this event on the traditional land of the Anishinaabe people. They include the Ojibwe, Odawa, and Potawatomi nations, known as the Three Fires Confederacy. At United Way, we honor Indigenous history and culture and promote the spirit and intent of reconciliation with respect for all First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people. We're so pleased that you could join us for this broadcast, our first ever, as I mentioned. And the reason for us doing it this way is because we still find ourselves in an environment that promotes physical distancing and doesn't allow us to host a documentary film series, which is an activity that we enjoy doing and gives us an opportunity to bring people together to learn about the social issues that are present across Simcoe Muskoka. As an alternative, in this environment, we are promoting the idea of still continuing to be informed and learn about the issues that were here prior to COVID-19, but in some cases have been made worse by this pandemic, but through a way that provides you with ease and health and safety while you safely listen from home. So let's begin. I'd like to introduce Doug Lanceborough, our Marketing and Communications Specialist at United Way Simcoe Muskoka, who is going to be narrating this broadcast for you, and he will be talking about the topic of social isolation. We're very grateful that you've tuned in. We hope you enjoy this, and we also hope that you might share your feedback with us. And Doug is going to tell you how to do that after the broadcast, but we hope to be able to learn from you as well. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, and thank you for joining us. As Dale mentioned, my name is Doug Lanceborough, and I'm the Communications Specialist here at United Way Simcoe Muskoka. I'll be your host in our first ever UWSM broadcast, and I'm going to be taking you on a deep dive into the very important and very real issue of social isolation. During this broadcast, we will be discussing what social isolation is and the effect it has on those experiencing it. We'll look at how it differs from loneliness and social distancing, and we'll also look at how social isolation affects different populations within Simcoe Muskoka, including seniors, youth, and marginalized communities. While many of us have felt isolated these past few months as we work to fight COVID-19, we will also look at how the coronavirus pandemic has affected those experiencing isolation. And at the end of the broadcast, we will talk about how local efforts are helping those living in isolation and how your support helps, some simple actions you can do to help someone you might know who's experiencing isolation during these difficult times. For your convenience, a transcript of this broadcast is also available on the same webpage where you download the sound file. Once again, thank you for joining us, and we hope you enjoy. Lately, many of us have been using the term isolation very loosely. It's not uncommon to hear a friend or relative say that they're self-isolating or socially isolating themselves, though our social distancing efforts should not be mistaken for social isolation. Social isolation is the state of being cut off from normal social networks, aside from those that are required for basic aspects of life, such as interacting with a bank teller or grocery store cashier. When isolated, you can actually count the number of meaningful interactions you might have in a day, a week, or even a month. These interactions could take place in person, over the phone, or virtually through email and social media. During a time when many people have dozens, hundreds, or even thousands of connections through social networks, some people might think that it's almost impossible to feel isolated, but that couldn't be further from the truth. Many barriers can prevent someone from having meaningful interactions, and even those with a network of 1,000 friends can feel alone. But how does someone become socially isolated? The most common cause of social isolation is a physical disability that creates barriers that can stop someone from leaving their house. This could include being confined to a wheelchair or being unable to walk for any number of reasons. The barriers created by a disability can trap someone in their house without supports or resources to help lower those barriers. According to Susan Dawes, the Client Services Coordinator at Independent Living Services of Simcoe County and area, physical disabilities can limit even a person's most basic social interactions, like going to a bank or a grocery store. As we'll see coming up in this broadcast, this can lead to a lack of self-worth, frustration, and mental and physical health risks. Hearing loss is the second most common factor that can lead to isolation. While hearing loss is a physical disability or impairment, it generally doesn't prevent someone from leaving their house. It can still isolate someone, though, even if they are frequently surrounded by friends and family. Because hearing loss is something that many people experience as we age, we'll talk more about this cause when we discuss how seniors are impacted by isolation. There are a large number of other factors that can lead to isolation, too. Mental health challenges such as depression, anxiety, and social adversity can all cause someone to become secluded from others, as can personal crises like caring for a loved one, bereavement or loss, long-term illness, and other family emergencies. Furthermore, victims of domestic violence often become isolated from their social network, and this isolation can also be part of the abuse itself. Income also plays a huge role in isolating someone. People living in low income cannot afford going out for social events when the choice is rent or meeting up with family or friends. This is especially true for those experiencing unemployment or underemployment, when paychecks are not guaranteed or insufficient for covering basic necessities. In a time when gaining employment can be a case of who you know rather than your experience, this means that employment, like many of these factors, can create a cycle that further entrenches someone in isolation. Low income or poverty can also create a technical barrier for those who are unable to afford a cell phone or phone plan to help them stay connected with friends and family or help with a job hunt. These are just some of the factors that lead to social isolation, and as we progress through this broadcast, you'll see that specific demographics and communities face increased threats from different factors. But for now, let's move on to what the overall impact of social isolation is. So we know what social isolation is, but how does it affect people living with it? Unfortunately, social isolation has been linked to a wide range of social, mental, and physical health risks. As we'll discuss after this section, loneliness is both a cause and symptom of isolation, but it's not the only social health implication. Isolation can also ingrain a fear or distrust of other people, both strangers and those you've known your entire life. What few relationships remain are constantly strained, driving someone further into seclusion. When it comes to mental health risks, isolation can cause increased rates of depression and anxiety. At its darkest, social isolation is a factor in those contemplating suicide, and those experiencing isolation continually face lowered self-esteem and increased stress, which are both linked to poor sleep and other unhealthy lifestyle habits. These are often part of the physical health risks attributed to isolation, and these physical health risks are many. Isolation can be so devastating that the University of California's Dr. Steve Cole calls it a fertilizer for other diseases. Exacerbated by the social and mental health risks, experiencing social isolation can help cancer cells spread, accelerates the buildup of plaque in arteries, and has been strongly linked to Alzheimer's and dementia. Furthermore, isolation has been linked to high blood pressure, heart disease, obesity, cognitive decline, substance abuse, and, in the worst cases, death. While all of these effects of social isolation are devastating enough on their own, they're made even worse by the fact that most of them are also factors of the situation in the first place. Without the proper resources, services, and support from friends and loved ones, all of these outcomes of social isolation will only isolate someone further. While important to understand what social isolation is and the impact that it has on people, it's also important to understand what it isn't. And in this next section, we're going to look at loneliness and social distancing, two terms that people have been using interchangeably with social isolation. When thinking about social isolation, it's easy to confuse it with loneliness. And while loneliness is also a difficult and painful experience for people, we should understand the difference between the two terms. Do you remember our initial definition of social isolation? It stated that isolation was a state of being cut off from society, one where you can easily count the number of meaningful interactions you have. This makes social isolation an objective state of being, one that can be measured and identified consistently across individuals experiencing it, and while those situations don't look the same, isolation is an ongoing, seemingly permanent experience for many. Loneliness, on the other hand, is a subjective experience. Somebody feels lonely, and this feeling is often temporary. It can be caused by many of the same factors that will lead to isolation, such as loss of a loved one or an injury, but loneliness can and often is recovered from. In some situations, though, loneliness will begin the cycle that leads to isolation, trapping someone in seclusion from friends, family, and the necessary resources that they need. While experiencing loneliness, mental health challenges may become more difficult and increase rates of social adversity. For this reason, loneliness is often one of the many causes of social isolation, though there are many people who can recover from loneliness because they have the supports and connections, even if at the time they don't feel like it. And loneliness isn't the only thing we tend to think is synonymous with social isolation. Since March, we have all come together to help mitigate the spread of COVID-19 through public health measures that none of us have experienced before. One of these measures, as I'm sure you're well aware, is social distancing. Social distancing has been an incredibly important method to not just slow down the spread of COVID-19, but to save lives. While distancing ourselves, it wouldn't be surprising to hear people say that they're quarantining or isolating themselves. And while we technically are isolating, it's important to remember that what the majority of us are experiencing is only a fraction of what social isolation really feels like. It has been difficult to refrain from social gatherings and outings, but for many of us, our connections and networks are still there. We participate in conference calls or Zoom meetings for work. We have family Skype sessions every week or so. We message our friends and family on social media or keep up with the photos they're posting. It feels different than it did back in March, but we are still connected during our social distancing. For those experiencing social isolation, those connections were not there before distancing measures were implemented, and they are definitely not there now. In fact, what few interactions a person who is isolated had, whether that be with customer service employees, regular appointments, etc., those are all drastically different, if they're there at all. And as we just discussed, many of those affected by social isolation are also facing increased health risks, limiting what few opportunities they might have to leave home. So now we have a base understanding of what social isolation is, what it isn't, and how it affects people who are experiencing it. Next up, we're going to look at how social isolation impacts different populations. Now let's be clear, everybody should be concerned about social isolation because it's an issue that can impact anyone, including our friends, family, and ourselves. A 2018 survey found that 40% of individuals have reported that they sometimes or always feel that they are isolated. With the current pandemic, that number is likely to be much higher. With that being said, there are certain communities that face increased risks from isolation or disproportionately suffer from social isolation compared to the majority of the population. To understand the full impact of this isolation, it's important to know how it affects these groups. Now, before we look at the specific impact on populations and communities, I want to note that the following sections will be disheartening at best and difficult to listen to at worst. We ask that you stay with us to get a better understanding of how social isolation harms Simcoe Muskoka residents. You can turn this broadcast off, but those experiencing social isolation cannot do the same with their situation. Our senior population includes some of the most vulnerable individuals facing isolation. As we age, there are many changes that occur that can drive someone further and further from their social networks and connections. Retirement, for example, marks the end of daily work relationships, which might mean no longer seeing good friends 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. At its most difficult, we might not think work is important for our social and mental health, but the majority of our regular interactions come from our jobs. And when someone retires, those interactions must be found elsewhere and will likely never replace the normal schedule we've all become used to. Tragically, as we age, we start experiencing the loss of friends and loved ones as well. Loss and bereavement have their own difficulties, and unfortunately this becomes more common the older we become. While those who have lost someone close to them struggle with that loss, something that might isolate them already, it also marks a loss of an important connection, further increasing the risk of isolation.
Particularly if that spouse was the social one. You know, oftentimes in a relationship, there's one individual that might be a little bit more extroverted than the other.
That's Jen Frimmer, Executive Director at Muskoka Seniors.
I think that that's an important thing too, is sort of recognizing the roles of a relationship and when that spouse is gone, what that can look like.
Jen also notes that losing your driver's license is one of the biggest isolating factors for many of our seniors.
When that is taken away, you are instantly dependent on somebody else.
And whether it be because of retirement or just aging and moving closer to family, a lot of seniors find themselves in new communities.
We've got a lot of folks that come to retire here, which is well and good, but it is not, or for some, it is not. It hasn't been their primary residence for a long time. And so their social group, their networks aren't even in this community.
Our body goes through physical changes as we grow older too. Aging can lead to physical limitations that can prevent someone from leaving their house, which we already noted was the number one cause of social isolation. Hearing loss is also a common change that occurs as we age. While hearing loss does not usually mean that someone cannot leave their house, it creates barriers wherever they go. A senior who is losing their hearing can be surrounded by their loved ones, but still feel isolated when they cannot hear or participate in conversations. And while hearing aids can remedy this, they are cost prohibitive and not an option for a lot of seniors on a fixed income. In addition to being more prone to isolation, seniors face increased risk from being isolated too. Without meaningful connections, seniors have shown increased cholesterol, weakened immune systems, and increased risks of dementia compared to seniors who have important social interactions. Unfortunately, aging also brings a whole host of other health implications that only compound with social isolation, making our senior residents one of the most at-risk populations. Specifically in Simcoe Muskoka, we have a lot of rural populations as well, and when our seniors live in a rural population, the geography itself can isolate them from others. For those living in Muskoka or northern Simcoe County, a lot of their neighbors are cottagers who are only around for 2, 3, or 4 months a year. And once those cottagers disappear for the season, their closest neighbor might be kilometers away. Though the experience of isolated seniors is often unique to an individual, retirement or aging often leads seniors, especially in new environments, to stay home more.
So they're at home. That then increases a risk of loneliness and could impact the risk of depression.
This then begins to affect someone's motivation, slowly impacting daily routines like getting ready for the day or even maintaining your home.
So now I'm not feeling very motivated, which then impacts our nutrition levels. And so now my nutrition levels are being impacted. And when that's impacted, that affects sleep, falls, weight, you know, like all of that. And so then you've got somebody who just moved to a new community, didn't seem like a big deal, and has the risk of now being unmotivated, at greater risk for falls, not malnourished, whatever that may be, all because of a move.
On the other end of the age spectrum, youth are particularly vulnerable to social isolation. It's during our formative years that some of the most important foundations of our lives are built, and the impact of loneliness and isolation while we're young can have implications later in our lives. First and foremost, academic success has been shown to be largely dependent on a sense of belonging. This belonging is important to create a positive social and emotional well-being, and its absence increases rates of depression in youth. Isolated children and youth also experience stress that people their age should not have to bear, which has not only been linked to physiological risks when they are young, but also impacts their health in adulthood. Studies on social isolation have also shown that a lack of strong relationships actually impacts the development of our brain structure, specifically the part of the brain responsible for many cognitive functions like planning, critical thinking, and social interaction. When it comes to preventing isolation, you might think that family connections are the most important. However, studies have shown that friendship-related isolation is much more harmful than parent-related isolation, though that's not to diminish the impact of the latter. A 2012 study of 4,500 youth found that social supports from friends and spending spare time with friends were the most important protective factors against mental health challenges. Growing up is a critical time for all of us, but it can also be an exceedingly difficult time, and the effects of being isolated while we're young carry well into our adulthood for both physical and mental health challenges. In the next section, we're going to be talking about how marginalized communities are more prone to social isolation and the impact that isolation has on members of these communities. The LGBTQ community is one of the communities that faces unique and harmful factors that can lead to social isolation. Similar to other groups we will discuss, many of these factors are environmental and social in nature. While Canadians pride ourselves in being an open and accepting country, discrimination and a history of harmful practices have led to the LGBTQ community being more vulnerable to isolation than most. While certain sexual orientations or gender identities encounter specific risk factors, there are some factors that apply to the entire community as a whole. These include feeling the need to hide or conceal your sexual orientation or gender identity, a fear of discrimination, past or current discrimination, housing discrimination, and systemic discrimination in society and in organizations that provide services. networks and connections that many people rely on can disappear when someone comes out to their friends and family, or it might be the fear of that rejection that leads to members of the LGBTQ community feeling invisible and alone. For this community, fear and discrimination are the two biggest barriers to creating a strong social circle and accessing supports, some of them critical, like shelter or transportation.
Social isolation in this area centers around lack of ability to have transportation.
That's Jerry Croteau, Executive Director of the Gilbert Center, an organization that services the LGBTQ community in Simcoe Muskoka.
Someone who is in Midland, there's one bus a day to Barrie and one bus back from Barrie to Midland, as well as many folks don't have access to high-speed internet.
And that's something that we see time again in people who are experiencing social isolation, particularly those in the LGBTQ community who need that transportation to get to support groups and resources.
Just getting to places has been a challenge and contributes a lot to being isolated.
Trans individuals face their own unique risks as well, stemming from a lack of support, negative social interactions, and an ongoing struggle to have their identities simply accepted by others.
We've had incidences where trans folks have gone into shops in not so much in Barrie, but in outskirts of Barrie, Midland, Orillia, Wasaga Beach, Collingwood, Bradford, and some of them have been detained by police because shop owners have called and said, there's some guy in here dressed as a woman in the lingerie department, you know, and they're not dressed as a woman, they identify as a woman and they are a trans person. A lot of landlords won't rent to you. It happens. Like, it's not frequent, but it has happened. So that's why I make point to it that, you know, that's one of the challenges that folks have. Also, just accessing medical services. If someone is transitioning or has transitioned but hasn't changed their name legally, so their OHIP card may still read John Smith, when in reality their preferred name is Allison Smith, for example, but when they give their OHIP card, it's John Smith, then they're in the waiting room and they get called John Smith, and here they are presenting as a female. It's awkward, embarrassing, and they tend to stay away from accessing medical help. I mean, I had a client come in here who was 29 years old and feeling isolated because at 29, he said, the first thing he said to me was, there's a female inside of me that wants out, and because I won't let her out, it's caused me to be isolated from my friends. I don't date. I don't go out. I just go to work and come home because I'm not comfortable in my own skin. And I don't know how to come out. I don't know how to get, and this female won't let me alone. Like, she wants out. You know what I'm saying? And that's heart-wrenching.
LGBTQ seniors are also more vulnerable to social isolation, both because of the innate risks associated with aging and because many grew up having their identity more stigmatized than they are today.
And also, remembering that up until 1969, it was against the law to be gay in Canada. There was a sodomy law. You could be imprisoned for being gay up until 1969. That's within my lifetime.
As a result, nearly half of all LGBTQ seniors live alone, either because they had to hide their sexual orientation or gender identity growing up, or because their relationships were not legally recognized during the years when they would form romantic relationships. And even those that did retire with their partners found that retirement brought its own set of obstacles.
George Smitherman, a former health minister for the province of Ontario, was once quoted as saying, it's a shame that seniors have to go back in the closet when they retire because a lot of retirement homes or long-term care facilities won't let seniors who have been together for 50 years be together in long-term care facilities or retirement homes because of the stigma against LGBTQ folks.
For LGBTQ youth, both unconscious and conscious discrimination pushes children and youth towards being heterosexual and, quote, normal. LGBTQ youth don't often have role models from their community. The act of coming out, while difficult at all ages, can be very isolating for youth and ingrains an identity of being different. An identity of being different can push LGBTQ youth away from seeking out others who are sharing or have lived through their experience, leading to a cycle of fear and self-stigmatism. For the LGBTQ community, like many of the marginalized communities we'll be talking about in this section, isolation does not come from a physical disability or mental health challenges, though those can all be contributing factors. Rather, isolation is almost forced upon these communities because of ingrained discrimination. Another such community, and the one we'll be discussing next, are Indigenous peoples. Indigenous peoples in our communities not only face increased social isolation, but are at higher risk for the factors that lead to isolation in the first place. Both First Nations and Métis residents have, on average, lower income than non-Indigenous residents. We already know that low income can lead to isolation through the inability to afford necessities and the barriers it creates to transportation and communication. In addition to lower income, the health of Indigenous peoples continues to lag behind the majority of the population of Canada and other communities. Racism is the biggest risk factor that can drive Indigenous peoples to social isolation. With systemic racism, there is not only a lack of access to resources for Indigenous peoples due to barriers created by poverty and inequality, but there are disproportionately fewer resources that are culturally appropriate. Similar to the LGBTQ community, Indigenous peoples are also driven from creating meaningful social connections for fear of racist views, rhetoric, and actions that still tragically exist across our communities and our country. Past racism also plays a large role in isolating Indigenous communities and individuals. Here's Megan Young, the Life Promotion Director with the Feather Carriers Leadership for Life Promotion at the Barrie Area Native Advisory Circle.
In terms of looking at a lot of the colonial policies that were developed and the way that Indigenous peoples have been, the relationship that's been fostered with Indigenous peoples, even rooting back to identifying who is First Nations, who's Inuit, who's Métis, a lot of that underpinning in those relationships was from the concept that Indigenous peoples are a problem, and so we need to divide and conquer in order to solve the problem. And so when you look at the policies that have been developed as a result of that kind of thinking, you can understand how from the very beginning that we've been separated and segregated and seen as other. And so all of those policies have a racist underpinning, oppressive underpinning, and have resulted in a lot of trauma for peoples and communities across North America and more broadly, like Indigenous folks globally. So when you look at the creation of the Indian Act, they impose those patrilineal systems. And so if your father was somebody who was considered to be a status Indian, they were able to pass on their status to their children, regardless of who the mother was. When you look at how that legislation was applied to women, that was not the case. So a woman who was registered as a status Indian at that time, she was only able to pass on her status to her children depending on who the father was. And that father also had to be a status person. Otherwise, her children would not be status. And so when you start to see how that works, and that starts to create this divide and conquer and these divisions in our communities, because you have people who are relatives who are no longer able to live in their own community, and it started to sever those relationships and separate family members from their networks of support. So when you start to see how legislation is imposed upon us, where mothers end up losing their status because they're with somebody who is non-status, and then are forced to leave their community, forced to raise their children outside of their communities, then you start to see how we have been impacted by this social and physical isolation from that time. And then that also happened as a result of, I'm sure as you're aware, through residential schools. So the education that our children received when they were in community was not seen to be important. It wasn't valued in any way. It was seen as being highly problematic. And so many different Christian denominations worked with the Canadian government to create the residential school system, and they felt that they could better educate our children and our communities and basically teach them how to be white people. And so the best way to do that was to remove children from their communities, have them live in an institution, and really try and program them, brainwash them into having a different understanding about life. And so through that, you also see how people are physically and socially isolated. They're taught that what their parents and grandparents and communities do is wrong, is sinful, is going to result them in, you know, going to hell. And so that creates a lot of shame and a lot of division and a lot of uncertainty about who they are as Anishinaabeg, as Haudenosaunee, as Mi'kmaq people, many different peoples, Métis peoples, Inuit. So when they're not able to learn and develop within their community an understanding of who they are, that also creates social isolation.
The last residential school in Canada only shut down in 1996. These institutions not only served to erase the social identity of Indigenous children, but perpetrated physical, sexual, and emotional abuse, created inhumane living conditions, exposed children to diseases, forced children into labor, and made those who left the school feeling as if their Indigenous identities were something to be ashamed of. This horrible practice created an intergenerational effect, which passed on the stress and grief experienced by Indigenous communities to create a collective experience of powerlessness. In a 2012 study, a sample of 127 residential school survivors found that 65% have been diagnosed with PTSD, 21% with major depression, and 7% with anxiety disorder. While these are individual diagnoses, the impact of residential schools has resulted in increased social isolation throughout the entire Indigenous population.
It's our belief, and part of the work that I do with Bannock is really to foster four primary health outcomes. So the Thunderbird Partnership Foundation worked with First Nations all across Canada to really look at and understand what are those things that we need to be healthy, thriving communities. And so the four main health outcomes that they found in those communities that were healthy and thriving are a strong sense of hope, meaning, belonging, and purpose. And so I think the one that specifically resonates with the questions and the work that you're doing is that sense of belonging. So if our understanding of who we are as peoples is stripped from us and we're taught that that's problematic, then it's difficult for us to have a sense of belonging in the world at large, but also with community. And so I think that's one of the pieces where racism plays a huge role. When you're perceived in a certain way on the outside, you have people telling you, you don't belong here because of how you look, that can create a lot of devastation.
Indigenous peoples are also overrepresented in our criminal justice system. While Indigenous peoples account for less than 5% of the country's population, they make up 20% of the total imprisoned population. While criminality has its own stigma associated with it that makes creating meaningful connections difficult, foremost among those is finding employment after incarceration. We discussed before that income is one of the most important determinants of social isolation. For a community that is overrepresented in the legal system, this presents a huge barrier to forming these essential supports. According to the John Howard Society of Ontario, 60% of employers require a criminal record check for new employees, and 15% do not hire someone regardless of the type of offense or age of a person when they were incarcerated. For Indigenous peoples leaving the criminal justice system, this only makes social isolation and all its harmful effects more likely.
A lot of the work that we're trying to do is trying to repair the devastation that's happened, repair these relationships, and shift the focus from one of that we're a broken people to one that we are healthy and thriving communities. And so I think sometimes it can be complicated when we're asked around social isolation, because yes, that still is very much a reality that many folks experience, especially like during a global pandemic where we're all experiencing it. But then having this history and having those policies and idea, that kind of thinking that regarding Indigenous folks, that, you know, either we're people that need to be helped or that we continue to be this other, I think that also contributes to our continued social isolation, and we're still trying to figure out how do we shift the focus from that, and how do we promote life, and how do we foster healing, and how do we work together to really foster connection.
The last demographic we will touch on in this broadcast will be newcomers and immigrants, though we have by no means covered every group that experiences social isolation. In fact, discussing any of the communities or demographics we've already touched on could take up an entire presentation longer than this broadcast. And as we said before, anyone can experience social isolation. The unique experiences of communities and demographics will create different risk factors or make them more prevalent for certain groups. For immigrants, though, there are some barriers in particular that make social isolation a bigger risk. A language barrier exists for some immigrants, which immediately prevents meaningful connections from being created. For those who do experience a language barrier, the remaining risk factors can be made even more difficult to overcome. Newcomers and immigrants commonly don't know about community resources, including those that can help create a strong social network. Employment also presents a barrier for immigrants, regardless of the language they speak. A study conducted by the County of Simcoe found that the immigrant population in Simcoe County possesses, on average, higher rates of post-secondary education, but experience higher rates of poverty at the same time. Those who move to Canada face unemployment and underemployment more than someone born in Canada, but not because of a lack of qualifications. Similar to other groups who face employment discrimination, income plays a large role in whether someone becomes socially isolated. While many residents of our communities have family and friends nearby, in the same house, on the same street, or maybe just a short drive away, many immigrants leave their social connections behind when they move to Canada. This means that, aside from the family and their home, meaningful connections are extremely limited. For immigrant youth and seniors, this can be especially damaging because of how vulnerable they already are to social isolation. Like other minority groups, discrimination and racism also excludes immigrants from feeling accepted or welcomed in their new home. This is especially true for visible minorities who face increased discrimination. Unfortunately, this can have an intergenerational effect. Though the children of immigrants might not face the same risk factors as their parents, racialized Canadians are still victims of racism that can lead to social isolation and other economic consequences and mental, social, and physical health problems. As I previously said, any of these communities or demographics and any number of other ones could be the topic of a broadcast similar to this one. For these groups that we just discussed, there are increased risk factors that can lead towards social isolation, and all of the negative consequences that come with that, whether they be threats to your social, mental, or physical well-being. We hope that hearing about these experiences has sparked an interest in you into learning more about social isolation and how you can help specific communities or people suffering from isolation. And while we will touch on that and the work being done in Simcoe Muskoka in just a bit, we also need to talk about how COVID-19 has affected those experiencing social isolation. It's no secret that our way of life has changed since the COVID-19 pandemic began. We're living through an event that nobody alive has lived through before. Our lives are being forced to change, both at home and at work, and, for better or for worse, the effects of social isolation are not immune to this change. For those already experiencing isolation, the effects were immediate and jarring. Some services that individuals relied on, transportation, counseling, and more, were open on a Friday, but did not reopen the following Monday. Throughout the charitable sector, those providing frontline services to people experiencing social isolation and other struggles have had to adapt how they can provide those services, if they can be adapted at all. Many are left wondering if they will be able to continue helping our communities most vulnerable in 6 months or a year. Mental health risk factors and those associated with income spiked in severity. Many Simcoe Muskoka residents are only now starting to go back to work, but more still find themselves unemployed. For those already living in low-income households, things got even worse. While there were some who found themselves in need of assistance for maybe the first time in their lives. Worse, it was not only physical limitations that kept people in their homes for days on end, it was necessary for all of us to stay home, away from our normal networks. For some seniors, staying inside and isolated became, tragically in many cases, a matter of life and death. those whose only meaningful connections consisted of their family were cut off from even them. I think we're all haunted by pictures of family members visiting their elderly loved ones from outside their window. For our youth, for those whose development is reliant on connecting with their friends, they suddenly found themselves not being able to see each other. They had to navigate a new learning format without being able to help or play with one another. For marginalized communities, services that were already limited in number and scope were reduced when they were needed most. The Albert Kennedy Trust, a UK charity that helps young members of the LGBTQ community who face homelessness, publicly advised young people to press pause on coming out during the pandemic. At a time when stress in households is higher than ever, and when resources and services for LGBTQ youth are limited, the charity warned that there was concern of families kicking their child out of the house if they come out now. But through all of the chaos and change that has marked this pandemic, we have also seen acts of kindness. People offering to shop for their immunocompromised neighbor, adults helping their elderly parents move in to give them that connection and safety during the pandemic, and probably more family video calls than we ever thought we could manage. When I spoke with Jerry Croteau of the Gilbert Center, he told me that COVID-19 had forced the organization to adapt, and as a result, they can actually help out more individuals.
COVID-19 has enabled us to do more online programming, and in fact, we've been heavily supported by many of our funders to enhance online programming because it keeps that social isolation from getting any more concerning for folks. And it has enabled folks to go online. And whereas before they had texting or emails, this way they can actually go online. And a lot of it is FaceTime or through Zoom meetings or Microsoft Team meetings, where people can actually interact by seeing others, not just hearing them, but actually seeing other folks. For example, in our youth programming, for youth who are questioning their sexuality or are transitioning from male to female or female to male, or are non-binary, they found now that because we have online programming, they now feel less isolated, if you will, because they actually can feel connected because they can go online with a whole bunch of other folks and be part of a program that normally would not allow them to be a part of because they can't get into Barry.
Inspired by these acts and in response to the increased needs of those experiencing social isolation, let's bring some hope to this broadcast as we look at how you can help. Being such a complex issue, social isolation doesn't have an easy solution. Someone's isolation could be caused by substance use, mental health challenges, domestic abuse, loss of a loved one, unemployment or underemployment, illness or disability, discrimination, or any one of the many, many risk factors we covered throughout this broadcast. These are deep-rooted issues, and as such, they might seem impossible to overcome. A great first step is one you've already taken by listening to this broadcast. You've educated yourself on social isolation. You can now be aware of the warning signs, understand what can cause social isolation, and don't simply shrug it off if you see these signs in a friend, family member, or coworker. I really like how Jen Frimmer of Muskoka Seniors put it when she told me that people should be reaching in and reaching out.
I think reaching in and reaching out is probably what I would suggest. As the individual themselves, do what they can to reach in. It's just reaching into that person's life in some way or another, whether it's just a call or spend the 5 minutes when you see them in their, you know, in their backyard to chat with them. Create an opportunity for social engagement in some way or another. And the reach out would be reaching out into the community to just educate yourself. If you're able to educate yourself in what is being offered, then when you have a conversation with somebody, then you can be the one that educates them on what's available.
Reach out to those close to you. Sometimes it can feel difficult to stay in touch with our friends and family, but keeping those connections is more important than ever. Remember that one of the factors that makes social isolation a cycle is that it causes people to draw back from the few meaningful connections they have. Be proactive and reach out to people in your life, whether you think they might be experiencing isolation or not. If you can do so responsibly and while respecting social distancing measures, visit those who you can. A chat in someone's driveway is better than a "see you when this is over." Find virtual ways to connect with people, through social media or video chats, to help make a meaningful connection with them during these difficult times. Even if you feel like you've had one too many of these video chats, it might be the highlight of someone's week. If you know someone who is experiencing social isolation or is in danger of experiencing it, reaching out to them might not be enough. Encourage them to connect with local resources or community navigators to get appropriate help. In Simcoe Muskoka, United Way Simcoe Muskoka funds 211 Central East Ontario, a 24/7 service that helps connect individuals with the services and organizations they need, even during a pandemic. Encourage friends or family to call 211 simply by dialing 211 on their phone or visiting 211ontario.ca if you think they need some help. Finally, your support is always welcomed and appreciated by organizations like United Way Simcoe Muskoka. Since the pandemic began, UWSM has increased funding to our Urgent Needs Fund to help address the increased needs of those who have become isolated, and we have provided funding for increased mental health services that can be accessed across our communities virtually or by phone. If you are able to give a gift and help our most vulnerable residents, like those experiencing social isolation, you can donate online at uwsimcoemuskoka.ca. From everyone at United Way Simcoe Muskoka, we'd like to thank you for joining us in our first ever UWSM broadcast. Social isolation is difficult, yet it's an important issue that too many of our friends, family, and neighbors face every day. By listening to this broadcast, you've taken that great first step. I'd also like to give a big thank you to the local experts who helped us all get a better understanding of social isolation. Jen Frimmer from Muskoka Seniors, Jerry Croteau from the Gilbert Center, Megan Young from Barry Area Native Advisory Circle, and Susan Dawes from Independent Living Services of Simcoe County and Area. We hope that you've come away from this broadcast with a new understanding of social isolation and some ways to help if you know someone who is isolated. Again, my name is Doug Lansborough, and it has been my privilege to be your host for this event. If you have any questions, you can email me at dlansborough, that's dlansborough, at uwsimcoemuskoka.ca, and I encourage you to connect with us on social at uwsimcoemuskoka. Let us know what you thought of the broadcast and what you learned. If you listened to this broadcast before July 27th, we would love to get your feedback through a survey you should receive this week. This feedback is so important in helping us for future events like this one. Thank you once again for listening and for supporting United Way Simcoe Muskoka and all those experiencing social isolation.